It's important to the internet that Congress and congressional staffers need to know. The co-chairs on the House side here are Congressman Bob Goodlatte and Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. On the Senate side, the co-chairs are Senator Thune and Senator Leahy. And there's other 100 other members of the Congressional Internet Caucus. And we work kind of cooperatively to host these kind of balanced debates about these important issues. Today's event is the future of surveillance laws 1 year after USA Freedom. Our media partner today is Vocative, and Kevin Collier, the moderator, is a senior privacy and security reporter with Vocative, so we're thrilled that we're working with them. The hashtag is Snowden Effect, and that's part of a three-part series, and this is the last of them that we've done on the Snowden Effect from the revelations of 2013. And if you want audio and video after this event to replay it or information, you can follow us at NEC Caucus AC. So with that being said, I want to thank the Congressional Internet Caucus and its co-chairs, Leahy, Thune, Goodlatte, and Eshoo. And I want to thank Vocative, and I'm going to introduce, just leave it to Kevin Collier. Thank you, Kevin.
Now we go. Thanks, Tim. Thank you so much for having us here. Should I introduce everybody? Or okay. This is Amy. I don't know how to say your last name.
Stepanovich
from Access Now. Bobby's general counsel at ODNI. Susan Hennessy is a senior fellow at Brookings and former NSA attorney. And
Aaron Cooper,
thank you. And at BSA, the Software Alliance, which represents, among other, Microsoft, Apple, Adobe. Okay. So this is kind of, we're gonna separate this into two general sections. We're gonna talk about both encryption and encryption backdoors, end-to-end encryption. And then separately, we're gonna address Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. So we're going to start with encryption. Both of these are relatively mainstream topics now compared to in 2013, I think. And they're both kind of born from a desire to make us more secure, though in different sense of the word, but come with their own potential problems. I don't want to shy away from technical talk in this, but if you guys have sort of an immediate response to something anybody else says, please jump right in. So let's start with this spring. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr, the previous and current chairs of the Senate Intelligence Committee, introduced a draft bill, you guys might be familiar, called the Compliance with Court Orders Act of 2016, which I think was a pretty controversial bill. And it's a big topic. I want to get into it later, but I want to really dive in head first with a really basic question that I think kind of sets the tone for where you guys are coming from. Which is, should companies be allowed to create for their users a communication system that is so secure that not even they, and by extension, a law enforcement agency, can read? Bob, do you feel comfortable jumping in?
Yeah, although, I mean, the fact of the matter is this is an issue that the administration has been working on for some time. The position of the administration is that at this time we're not seeking legislation. We're hoping to work with companies. It's very clear everybody in the administration, including the law enforcement and national security people, have said we need to have strong encryption propagated throughout society to protect individuals. And the more we see about cyber attacks, the more pressing that need becomes. Everybody should have it and use it. At the same time, there are genuine social costs to it, not only to national security, but even more so to law enforcement, which is starting to find an increasing inability to gain access to evidence that it needs to protect people. And so the question is, can we work with companies to find a solution to the problem? Typically, what you hear in response is, there's no way to provide for law enforcement access without increasing the risk, and therefore we can't do it. And I think that's a wrong approach in a couple of respects. The first is that the question is not whether there is some increased risk, because yes, there is going to be some increased risk. The question, and it's the same question we ask ourselves in a whole variety of contexts, is there a risk that we can manage such that it becomes less than the social benefit? I mean, there would be a lot fewer people killed in this country if no car was able to go faster than 35 miles an hour. But we don't do that because we've made the trade-off between the risks and the benefits. We would all be more secure in our homes if nobody could ever be the subject of electronic surveillance. Again, we've made trade-offs there because the social benefit of allowing electronic surveillance outweighs the risks. And that's the way the question should be looked at. And related to that, when I sit down privately with representatives of tech companies, they tell me, technically, we know how to solve this problem and manage the risk. The real issues are political and policy, which is under what circumstances do we want law enforcement to have access? And in particular, how can we set up a system, or can we set up a system, that allows for lawful access by the United States and yet does not allow foreign countries who are perhaps less scrupulous to do things that we don't think they should be able to do. But that's a policy discussion, and it's one that we need to have in the public going forward. And I think that the kind of blanket assertion that says there's no technical way to do this defeats the ability to have that discussion.
So to tie this, the encryption question has been around for a really long time. And to tie it back in to the theme of this series, probably the number one Snowden effect, I think, that we've seen since 2013 has been the increase of encryption deployed by companies, and particularly the move toward incredibly strong encryption. It's the thing that we've seen probably more than legal reform or policy reform, is this idea that the tech needs to adapt to a different environment. But again, this question isn't new. We've been fighting the fight over encryption since the 1970s, when it was over export controls, into the 1990s over backdoors and the Clipper chip, and then in today with going dark and the question of law enforcement access. So I think it's important to emphasize that this is not a new battle. This is not a new discussion. It's something that we've engaged on for quite some time. I think another element to the calculus that Bob put forward, though, is whether or not we can do anything that will be effective. And actually, to take a step back, Kevin, you phrased the question in a very interesting manner, which is, should companies be able to deploy services that not even they can have access to the content? And I'd argue that even when they try to do that, it's not necessarily true that they're successful. I believe I saw a statistic just yesterday that said over 90% of products shipped ship with a known vulnerability, which is an incredibly high ratio. Even when we are when we have companies trying their hardest to put out secure messaging or communication systems that only people who have authorization to gain access to those communications, the sender or receiver or the owner of a device, can access those, they still have vulnerabilities that can be exploited. Now, it definitely raises the cost of gaining access to those systems. When all traffic on the internet is encrypted, you can no longer intercept and scan all traffic on the internet, which means you have to target certain communications. You have to spend a little more time and effort. When an iPhone is encrypted by default, you have to purchase a very expensive exploit to break into that iPhone. You can't just access the hard drive. It does raise the financial investment in conducting surveillance, but you can't necessarily say it cuts off surveillance, potentially in some aspects, but there are so many vulnerabilities out there that can be taken advantage of that it's not necessarily the end of the story. And the other part of this is it going to be effective in total? I would argue that the default settings, whether or not your iPhone has default encryption on its hard drive, whether or not you can use WhatsApp and get strong end-to-end encryption, those changes make a hell of a lot of difference for the common person, for the person who picks up the application or the phone and is trying to just make sure that they're communicating with their loved ones, their doctors, et cetera, as securely as possible. For the terrorists and the criminals that are really determined, though, If those systems are built with back doors or some way for law enforcement to get in, they're still going to be able to gain access to systems that don't have those back doors and that don't have the mandates for law enforcement to have access. There was a report, I believe it was last year, though it might have been earlier this year, because this year feels like it's been quite long, about the popular messaging systems with end-to-end encryption. Most of them aren't based in the United States. A lot of them are based overseas, so U.S. mandates are not going to touch what the manufacturers necessarily have to do when they're developing those systems. We're going to have systems that can be developed by the criminals or by the terrorists themselves. We're going to have systems that are free and open source, and therefore we know exactly what's built into them, and they can't be modified to include a backdoor. So part of this whole calculus, I think, is the extent to which any mandate is going to make regular people much more insecure, because we're devoting resources that we should be taking to enhance the security of products and reapportioning them to lessen the security of products. And are they going to be effective at actually lessening or allowing easier investigations into the crimes? And it doesn't appear facially that that's going to be the case.
So I think we have to stop having sort of the first principles argument and get into a more pragmatic place in this discussion. It appears like right now we're even having a fight over whether or not this is a problem, right? So Amy mentioned there might be other ways to address these issues, right? It's not really going to stymie law enforcement. There's other mechanisms to sort of don't potentially have decryption mandates. I think that we need to start having a far more holistic conversation than just sort of the encryption issue. Personally, I tend to sort of agree with Bob that question is, it's really one of managed risk as opposed to can you do it absolutely safely or should you not do it at all? It's pretty clear that both the Feinstein-Burr legislation in particular and also sort of CALEA to these broad performance standard decryption mandates, they're not politically feasible, right? It's sort of it's a symbolic conversation at this point. So I do think that we should use the opportunity to start answering questions of alternatives, questions like whether or not lawful hacking can actually solve this problem, and also to sort of divide the encryption question itself into two parts. One being whether or not companies should be required to design their systems in a particular way, right? So should companies essentially retain the ability to access data? But then the separate question of what kinds of technical assistance should they provide whenever they are able to do so, right? That's sort of one piece of the Apple FBI controversy that was a little bit lost in some of the noise or sort of the inflamed rhetoric, that Apple did actually retain the capacity. So those are really difficult legal questions. There's a lot of difficult policy questions, but we're going to have to start answering sort of those pragmatic legal policy resource sort of questions in a way that thinks about the problem as a whole. I think what is emerging right now is a little bit of a trend of generalized opposition, and I actually think that this is potentially is traceable back to Snowden, although of course a lot has happened, but a little bit of an expectation that it is now the obligation of technology companies to essentially, the way that they represent their users' interests is essentially to oppose the U.S. government sort of wherever they think they might be able to. Apparently, even in some cases in which those companies believe the law does require that they provide particular types of assistance. I think the issue is that if the answers to some of the fundamental and foundational questions of lawful hacking or technical assistance, right, those other sort of mechanisms that might allow companies to develop security systems unimpeded and also allow law enforcement to do enough of the job that we're comfortable with whatever equilibrium we're at. The problem is that if that's not possible, right, so if we sort of the fight is lost there through efforts to kind of resource constrain the government or sort of be oppositional upon every metric, that's going to mount a lot of pressure on these far more difficult questions, blunter instruments. And so I think that it's important to sort of take a step back and really think about where can we make demonstrable gains along which metrics? And if we can't sort of get to a place in which we solve enough of the problem, you know, whether or not it's time to just kind of have that fundamental values clash that is really about different types of security and what we care about as citizens.
So I'm impressed with the discussion so far, because too often, I think, in debates about encryption, the rhetoric matches the metaphors that we use. So we usually talk about the fight, the encryption battle, things like that, and the rhetoric ends up getting to a place where you have to be on one side or the other. It is not set up in a way where there can be constructive conversations. And I think it's important that we, one place I might disagree is, I think first principles are useful in that there are so many places where whichever polar side you might find yourself on, we can all agree as to what our objectives are. So we want law enforcement to keep us safe. We probably all want that. We all want our data to be kept secure and our communications to be kept private. We all want critical infrastructure to remain secure. We all want a lot of the same policy results. How we get there, we might have differences, but if we can't start from a set of understandings that one side is not trying to ruin the other side, nobody wants to be less safe and nobody wants our critical infrastructure to be less secure, our data and communications to be less secure, I think that's an important place to start the conversation from. I think we all also probably want to make sure that outside of whether you can break end-to-end encryption or there are ways of creating backdoors or getting information in the clear, we want to make sure that if you're the sheriff in Burlington or Tuscaloosa, that you have the best information about how to try to get the information that you lawfully have access to. And I think that by creating an understanding about where we share principles and where we share objectives, that can help make that conversation better so that we can provide the best resources and information to state and local law enforcement across the country in a way that can be helpful on a day-to-day basis as we're trying to combat the next attack and gather the evidence necessary to prosecute offenders.
Can I? I just want to respond quickly to a couple of the points that Amy made, which I think were very good points. On the issue of other vulnerabilities, just three quick points. The first is it's more than a little bit more expensive. I actually don't know how much it cost the FBI to break into that Apple phone. Press reports threw around numbers like $800,000 or $1 million, and that's for one phone in one case. The sheriff of Burlington or Tuscaloosa is not going to have those resources available ever. The second point is, of course, that these vulnerabilities are vanishing. When you use one and you have to disclose that you've used it, it goes away, and there's a finite number of them. And the third is, of course, that there is equal pressure on the government to, every time it discloses a vulnerability, to disclose it to the company so that it can fix it. And there's a process within the government, which is called the vulnerabilities equities process, to decide in an individual case, is this something that we need to preserve for use, or is this something where it's more important to let the company know so it can protect the public? So while the ability to capitalize on other vulnerabilities does provide some degree of mitigation, it's pretty limited. Secondly, I completely agree with Amy that you've got to address the issue of whether it's going to be effective, and in particular, the availability of other means of communications. The fact of the matter is that for decades, mafia dons have talked on the telephone despite the fact that they know that they're going to be wiretapped doing that. People do not take all the precautions they could. And another mitigating factor here is that, by and large, American products are better than the rest of the world. And it seems to me that a person seeking privacy might really assess, do I want to use an American product where I know exactly what's involved, because we're public and transparent about when we can get access, or do I want to use some Romanian product that I download from the internet where I have no idea what's built into it? So yes, it's not going to be perfect. Yes, we do have to figure out, one of the things we do have to assess is, okay, what is the impact of this going to be on a global market? But again, that's one of the factors that has to go into the discussion.
I want to emphasize something that Susan said that I think is incredibly important, which is there are so many other conversations to be had beyond this conversation. I think Bob touched on this with the vulnerabilities equities process. There's a hugely developing number of policy experts who are engaging on the question of the vulnerabilities equities process, Susan of which is among them and has wrote many pieces, which I disagree with in part, but I really respect her for being out and on the front end of this conversation and engaging in that conversation, and everybody else who has. The question of lawful hacking and when that should take place. Access Now actually recently wrote a report where we talked about how we think there needs to be a law with very heavy safeguards, specifically geared toward government hacking, instead of trying to put it into existing frameworks, and that the uniquely invasive nature of government hacking necessitates this additional statutory authorization for the activity, not only in the United States, by the way, but in other countries as well. And so that is a really important conversation. And then I think that there are conversations that we haven't even thought of yet, but when we come to resolutions on those conversations, they will have a huge impact on this conversation on encryption that we continually engage in. And one example that I like to bring up is this question of digital estates, what happens to our information after we die. And the idea that if it could become the norm for people to actually have a plan for this, and we're working in that direction, actually. Once there is a plan for your digital information after you die, that actually becomes an extra tool for law enforcement to get access to information that they need. Which I think is really fascinating. I think there are other inventive solutions like that that don't involve undermining encryption, but that can help law enforcement. And those are really the discussions that I think I would really like to be having and that I think are really valuable to have, and getting away from this other discussion on encryption, which we keep having over and over again for decades.
I think one of sort of... I agree with that largely. I think one of the sort of the emerging trends that is troubling for people who think about sort of how to get to pragmatic, maybe least bad solutions here, is a little bit of an emerging trend to an emerging belief that the best way to constrain the government is through resource constraint, right? So not through legal or policy constraints or sort of those collective decisions that we all make, but instead sort of making it more difficult for the government to do its job. So I don't mean that quite as cynically as it sounds, right? That actually is a really effective way, right? It is a really important constraint on the government. So we've seen Justice Sotomayor in the very famous Jones case sort of talked about that we needed to rethink sort of how difficult it was for the government to do its job and whether or not that changed some baseline assumptions. The problem is, I think what is emerging a little bit is a broad strategy to sort of use that resource constraint in a lot of different places, is leading to sort of this adversarial clash that's coming up over and over again, right? So Bob mentioned the question of disclosure, right? So some of the same people that oppose decryption standards or sort of have a particular position kind of in the going dark debate also strongly favored the disclosure of vulnerabilities and are involved in litigation to really both in immediate litigation involving sort of the FBI's operations, trying to encourage the FBI to disclose or to for judges to mandate that the FBI disclose particular vulnerabilities, and also in a larger sense sort of attempting to push the vulnerabilities equities process to a place where a far more significant amount is being disclosed. So those are the kinds of, that is the kind of trend that I think we all need to think really hard about. The other place that maybe I'm sort of alone in this, and certainly coming from the national security community, this might be unusual. I actually think terrorism is not really the place to have this conversation. So Bob mentioned law enforcement. The place that this is a real issue is child sexual exploitation. If you talk to anybody in the FBI about sort of real use cases for when going dark really impeded their ability to do critical work, it involved the access to content information in child sexual exploitation cases that has a dramatic impact on the ability to identify and rescue child victims, right? The absolute sort of most core law enforcement function. We've largely avoided that conversation, in part because it's uncomfortable, right? This is really, really difficult stuff to even imagine, let alone have sort of a public conversation about. I also think that there's a little bit of a fear from sort of the advocacy community that it feels emotionally manipulative, right? That it's sort of this attempt to put, you know, children being exploited to sort of overcome the rational defense of rights. I think that if we can get to a place where we can have a level-headed conversation in that very practical as-applied space, that's where we're going to start coming up with real pragmatic solutions. That's where we're going to get to a place where we all agree on the outcome we want to see, and really we're going to have conversations about values and sort of operational constraints. As long as we're having this sort of broadly untethered thing, particularly around terrorism, that has become a fraught discussion for a lot of different reasons, I'm not hugely optimistic that we're going to get to a place that is particularly constructive.
So I'd like to agree and disagree with that. So I think that every time we try to have the conversation just about how it affects one specific type of, whether it's a crime or a data security issue or a personal privacy issue, we lose sight of addressing that one issue creates other effects, known unintended effects in other areas. And I think that taking a more holistic, as you said at the outset, holistic approach to how do you try to make sure that law enforcement can get access to the data that it needs without having the unintended consequences that we all want to avoid, I think that type of larger conversation is helpful so that we don't try to solve one problem and create numerous other unintended consequences.
Bob, would you mind addressing what Susan kind of brought up, that the idea that child exploitation cases are actually kind of secretly the really big issue, more than terrorism, for going dark?
Well, I can't speak for law enforcement. I do know that child exploitation cases are a huge concern, but I think there are a whole range of law enforcement cases that are concerns. I mean, murder cases where you find a dead body with a cell phone next to it. How do you get access to the data on the cell phone? And it's going to be, as encryption propagates throughout the economy, it's going to be a growing problem throughout law enforcement. So while I think child exploitation is one of the paradigm cases, it's not the only one.
And I believe this is the case, that the FBI is right now trying to disclose some information about the cases where encryption, they say, has played a part in impeding their investigation. And one of the big problems here has been that we don't have a lot of information on what those cases are exactly. So it's been hard to engage with the FBI on a lot of these conversations because we have to do it at this 5,000 foot level because we don't have a lot of information digging down other than generally child exploitation or generally murder cases. We know, for example, that there is one case where every case in this space is just incredibly tragic on both sides. But this woman was murdered. She kept a diary on her phone, and they thought maybe the diary on her phone might provide some information on who had murdered her, and they wanted to get access to her phone. And it was actually delving into that case and trying to think about it hard that led me to think about the digital estate issue and what would have happened if she could have planned for her phone post-death. And once we have those cases and we can really delve into them, then we can start thinking about these more inventive solutions. But it requires that information. And so the FBI, I believe, has promised to provide that information. And I actually really look forward to that and to engaging on that second level of the debate.
Can I say, I worry a little bit as we go down the path of what types of cases is the FBI most concerned about or local police force most concerned about, that there's an implication that service providers are trying to make it more costly or more difficult to get access to data that they lawfully have access to. And I think that's not the case. And that a lot of the discussion needs to be around how do we make sure that that our data is secure. Government uses encryption technology for a lot of the same reasons that all of us use encryption technology, because we want to make sure that our communications are kept secure and the data that we're storing is kept secure and so on. So I just worry that as we think about just individual cases, that it leads to the conclusion that some people want to help law enforcement and some people don't. And I hope that's not the case, because I think that service providers, those in the public interest community that don't want to see back doors, all want law enforcement to be able to do their job. It's just that there are unintended consequences to some of the policy proposals.
Bob, earlier, if I heard you correctly, I think you said that you had spoken with people in the tech community who said, with regard to going dark, we know how to deal with the problem and manage the risk.
Yeah, I mean, the way it's been phrased to me is this is a technical problem we can solve. From a technical point of view, we can create a system that allows for lawful access to strong encrypted communications with a manageable degree of risk. From a technical point of view.
So Aaron, as our token industry guy here, I wonder if you can address that.
I cannot. I haven't had those conversations, so I can't address it.
All right. either of you guys like to tackle that or?
No, I think it's, I don't think either side is necessarily misrepresenting, right, or saying different things in private. Like, the question is always one of managed risk, right? I think both sides would agree that it's not, you know, if you put in a backdoor, it's anybody can get any data at any time, right, that systems are different. It's really sort of a difference about what level of risk actually results from particular systems, what are the unintended consequences, how scalable is a given solution. So I think sort of that question of what risk looks like in different sort of manifestations. Clearly, there is a technical solution, right? It's just a question of what that might look like and whether or not we can safely manage those trade-offs. I think the large companies almost certainly can. Sort of less sophisticated actors maybe not. But I think that sort of that risk conversation is the one that there's debate over, not the technical capability.
I think it's risk and complexity. So adding some of these capabilities adds complexity to a system. And if you talk to technologists, they'll tell you complexity is the enemy of security. So you're adding extra features, extra things that could potentially have unknown risk or unknown vulnerabilities that could then be exploited. And so it's this question of, you know, technologists try to make systems to lose as much complexity as possible. You want to make them very simple because then you can build them as securely as possible, but then again, they're going to have vulnerabilities probably anyway. Adding complexity adds potential for risk and adds potential for vulnerabilities.
And a technical solution would only be a technical solution to the services and architecture that we know today, not necessarily to what the world will look like in 5 or 10 years.
All right, I want to move for now to the sort of second big topic we're addressing, which is Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which people not in the Intelligence Committee or community often kind of refers to one of the major legal authorizations for some of the broader surveillance programs used by the NSA. Bob, again, I know you're... Well, I was actually going to ask if you wouldn't mind, just that in the very brief sense, if you can explain what Section 702 is intended for.
Sure. When FISA was originally passed in 1978, through a variety of technical and legal limitations, the intent was that surveillance of non-U.S. persons outside of the United States was not going to be covered by FISA. What happened over time was the method by which communications were transmitted changed, and the technical and legal limitations that were put into FISA, and it would take much too long to go through it in detail now, although I know there are some people in the audience who are familiar with them already, but they no longer worked to exclude a lot of this kind of foreign surveillance from FISA. And so in the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, Congress set up a new procedure under Section 702, which essentially applies to surveillance that is targeting non-U.S. persons outside of the United States with the assistance of U.S. communication service providers. And because the targets are not persons with Fourth Amendment rights under our law, the law doesn't require an individual warrant based on probable cause. What it does is that the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence submit annual certifications to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which outline the nature of the foreign intelligence to be gathered, the targeting procedures to ensure that the only people who are targeted are, in fact, non-U.S. persons outside the United States, and minimization procedures that apply to minimize the collection, retention, and dissemination of information about United States persons that you're inevitably going to acquire, even when you're targeting non-U.S. persons outside the United States. Once the FISA court approves the targeting and minimization procedures, then the intelligence agencies, pursuant to those targeting procedures, can identify targets, again, non-U.S. persons outside of the United States, and serve an order on a communications provider to produce those communications. That's a very high-level summary of how 702 works.
Thanks. And Susan, is there anything that you think is particularly relevant you want to add on to that?
No, I think that's the broad overview of the issues. Of course, Section 702 will come up for reauthorization at the end of 2017, so there's a forcing function in needing to address some of the concerns. There can be a little bit of confusion about the difference between FAA and 12333, which is the United States authority to collect information outside of U.S. territory, right? That can be, it can become confusing sort of whenever we're talking about foreign targets versus U.S. targets. One thing I think that is quite different here than some of the legislative debates that we've had sort of post-Snowden, particularly the 215 debate, is sort of some of the expectations about 702. I don't think that there are very many people who expect that 702 will not be reauthorized at all. The question really is whether or not there will be a clean reauthorization of 702. It will be reenacted in its currently existing form, or whether or not there is a need to modify it to either increase particular protection, place additional protections either for U.S. persons or foreign persons, or to potentially change some of the procedures. So it already is a much more nuanced, detailed conversation than even ones we've seen kind of over the past 3 years.
To put you on the spot again, would you personally like to see it modified, and if so, how?
No. If I was a voting member of Congress, I would vote for a clean reauthorization of 702, in part because I've seen the incredibly robust procedures and protections that exist inside the U.S. intelligence community. I'm confident that no information of anyone around the world is being abused, much less sort of the practical interactions with incidentally collected U.S. persons data. That said, I recognize that asking people sort of to trust me, I saw everything's fine, is not necessarily sufficient. And so I do think we need to think not necessarily about how to change the substantive realities, right? Because I think sort of once we get past some of the, the more grandiose charges about what has occurred and what hasn't occurred, I think based on the actual evidence that exists, there really is not a record of abuse here. However, I think there are ways to be more reassuring to the American public. So I think certainly about transparency metrics, so potentially building in additional mechanisms for U.S. people, for U.S. citizens to sort of understand how this program works. Potentially to have a conversation about sort of post-collection use, right? So how the FBI might access or use this data for other purposes that are not sort of related to counterterrorism or foreign intelligence. So I think there are places to have constructive debates and really important debates. I wouldn't be surprised if there were worthwhile conversations or even worthwhile changes, but sort of as a person who has seen soup to nuts data come in at the level of involvement from all the branches of government, I believe it's an incredibly important program. I believe it saves U.S. lives, not to mention lives around the world, and that in its current form, it's not abused, and there's very little. It would be, not only is it factually not abused, I think it would be incredibly difficult to abuse, sort of considering the protections in place.
Amy, would you like to weigh in on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there is a legitimate question that, unfortunately, as my colleagues at the ACLU know all too well, a question about whether or not 702 as a law is constitutional. And so setting that question aside for now, because I think it's going to be one of those questions that there's never agreement by many of the people at this table on, the question then becomes, if it's going to be reauthorized, should it be reauthorized cleanly or with additional safeguards? If it is going to be reauthorized, I would say there need to be significant additional safeguards. Not only narrowing the purposes for which information can be collected, which is, it's fairly broad, and increasing court involvement. The court's involvement with 702 is incredibly limited, so increasing court oversight. But also, in reflecting on the cross-border transfer issues that we've had this year with the European Union, and the idea that under Presidential Policy Directive 28, we now recognize policy, quote-unquote, interests for people outside the United States, but not privacy rights, and that's having, as perceived, a demonstrable impact on the economic security and the ability of companies to transact business with the EU and potentially with other jurisdictions, that we need to address actually protections for the people who are at most risk of being surveilled under 702, which is people outside of the United States. So protecting people in the United States, adding additional protections, making sure that there is, for example, a warrant requirement for access to U.S. person data, which is something that has been proposed in Congress previously, but also actually saying, moving from the idea that people outside the U.S. have privacy interests, but largely can be spied upon very, very broadly, to saying there are actually privacy rights that these people have, and how do we limit and make sure that innocent people outside the U.S., while still getting to the people who law enforcement needs to have access to their communications, but that innocent people cannot be looped up in very broad surveillance programs.
I want to slightly change this because we're running low on time. But given the complexities of an act like the FISA Reauthorization Act, given the difficulty of, or for example, how widely criticized the Feinstein-Burr bill was, this stuff is hard, and they lead to programs that it might be very difficult for a senator who's given certain briefings and to be able to make the best call for what a bill should look like. So. Okay, kind of a bigger question. Is this a fair system for how we create the laws that authorize these programs, Senate Intelligence Committee like this? Do we trust the senators who are writing these bills, or should we?
Do you have an alternative to propose?
Other than
using Congress?
Absolutely not, no.
I think we're 14 months away from when Section 702 is going to expire, which usually means that we're about 13 and a half months away from when a lot of the discussions happen. But I think what we've seen in the 702 discussion so far is we've had hearings in the House and the Senate, and it's taken on a lot of the same bipartisan tone that was part of the USA Freedom Act, which made the USA Freedom Act so successful. And so I think that there's a lot of reasons to be encouraged that the kinds of discussions that led to USA Freedom will lead to will be part of the debate on Section 702, and that's generally a good thing. It leads to transparency. We need transparency in how 702 operates. We also need transparency in the process that creates any potential changes to the way it works. So I think there's reason to be encouraged about what we've seen so far in the process, what we saw in the most recent related enactment of USA Freedom. So I think that's all a positive.
So there's actually a considerable degree of transparency about 702 and how it operates at this point. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board did, like a 250-page report, which laid it all out there. There's really very little about how the program operates that is, in fact, not known. I guess I disagree with Amy about the role of the FISA Court. I think they actually play a very active role as the various opinions castigating NSA for its incompetence over the years have shown. And they get regular reports on exactly how it's being operated, what's being done. The fact is that, as Susan said, this is not a program that has ever been subject to any kind of abuse. It is well run. It is extensively overseen by NSA, by the Department of Justice, by ODNI, by the FISA Court, and I think the PCLOB report came to that conclusion. So I don't think there's a need for any kind of fundamental changes. I think Susan is right that we should look at ways we can be more transparent while recognizing that there are costs to that, both in terms of the resources necessary to achieve transparency. Some of the steps that need to be taken to achieve transparency are difficult and complicated and themselves in some respects privacy intrusive. But I think it's something we're open to considering as we go forward.
And just to sort of respond, I think, to a premise of your question, which was when Congress is legislating highly technical materials, you know, the difficulties there, as well as the difficulties of sort of the committee structures sort of specific to intelligence. Look, the senators and staffs that work on intelligence issues are tremendously complex, tremendously sophisticated about these issues, both the technology, the law, right? They spend a lot of time, you know, in windowless rooms, really diving into this material. So I think the idea that they're not sophisticated actors is probably not true. That said, I do think that one sort of challenge here is the ability of those committees to meaningfully educate non-committee members, right? So, of course, members you know, have access to classified material by certificate of election, but their staffs might not, right? There's some impediments to sort of sharing that information. I think one way that we might have sort of a more constructive debate with all parts of Congress, including members that might have very different sensibilities about sort of, right, in some sense, the intelligence committees can be self-selecting for the people who care the most about, you know, one side or the other. I would hope that we would see things like declassified use cases, right, sort of not just allowing Congress to interact on these issues in more concrete terms, really get their minds around it, but to do so in an unclassified space and format. I think there is a way to do that that protects sources and methods that's going to allow them not only to have a meaningful discussion with one another, sort of in public, but also educate their constituents about why they're voting the way they are, what they think those constraints should look like. And so I'm hopeful that there's space in there, not just sort of the formal transparency of 702 reauthorization, but also that the intelligence community might consider sort of leaning forward on really wanting to arm them with as much unclassified information as they can whenever they have this really difficult and important discussion.
And just to be clear, since I have oversight from both sides of the Hill, I want to say that everything that Susan said about the competence of the Senate, and its staff applies to the House and its staff as well.
I would just add the importance of making sure, I think, that members of Congress should, non-committee members, should also have access to getting clearances for their staff. There's a movement toward that, which would allow other members to be able to engage with their staff more meaningfully on classified issues. I think that there is a great movement right now toward getting members with staff that have technical knowledge. There's a great program called Tech Congress to get actual technologists into congressional offices that I think will be really important for accountability and for oversight of these issues, because the tech can often be incredibly complex, and it's hard to understand without a tech background unless you have somebody with a tech background trying to explain it to you. And then the third part of this, I think, is a matter of jurisdiction, because you kind of asked this question not only about the 702 question, but also about the encryption question, I believe. And I think you specifically mentioned the Burr-Feinstein bill, which now in the most recent draft that we've seen is almost specifically targeted toward law enforcement. So I'm not totally sure why it remains in the Intelligence Committee dealing with this issue. But it means that they're having classified briefings on this matter. It means that there's information that's not being made public. And it to me, is unclear why we're defaulting to the most secretive committees in Congress when the question of jurisdiction seems to fall clearly outside of the Intelligence Committee.
I mean, look, sort of there's the real discussion underlying this, which is forum shopping among committees, right? There's a belief that those who favor sort of government access to data will find sort of friendlier voices in the Intelligence Committee. The Judiciary Committee, for example, that's less likely, or the possibility of sort of putting legislation on the floor is less likely, right? So there's, I think it's important to just sort of acknowledge the practical realities here. The other thing I think is, is sort of unfair about some of the conversations that emerged over the Burr-Feinstein bill, which I actually think represents a pretty unfortunate sort of missed opportunity, right? There's sort of some of the responses to the Burr-Feinstein bill have really been representations that the drafters of that legislation don't understand technology or don't understand math, right? They've made a mistake, and actually, if they just understood what the consequences would be, they wouldn't have done this. I don't think that's the case at all, and I think if you actually read the legislation, it's pretty clear that's not the case at all. There's a values clash here, right? There's a difference of opinion about which sort of security values are most important and about whether or not it's possible to manage the risks. So I also think that it's, you know, as much as I think it is important to have technical specialists and have a technologically informed conversation, it's also important not to dismiss everything we disagree with on values grounds as technologically illiterate, because it's not, right? And that just, I think it delays and masks sort of important conversations, important opportunities to engage on those sort of fundamental questions based on concrete legislative proposals, right? Instead of having kind of an untethered discussion that nobody quite knows what we're talking about, I think there was tremendous value in putting something on the table so there can actually be a specific discussion. In some ways, I think it was too bad that there was more of a focus in response to that bill on kind of the broad issues of the broad ideological issues and less of an opportunity to really have a discussion about practical consequences, unintended consequences, genuine risk management. And I would hope that as we see bills coming out from other committees or additional drafts of that legislation, we might have a more sort of focused and productive conversation.
We've got to move to questions. Sorry, you're working into one of the question answers. Bob's only got 5 more minutes. We can take a couple questions after that. But if anybody has any in particular that involve him, but even if not, yeah, please, love to take questions. The question, if I need to repeat this, is what areas of 702 need to be more transparent?
I guess I'm a little reluctant to be specific about that because I'm speaking for myself here. Other agencies might have different views about it. As people may know, I'm a pretty strong advocate for transparency, but I think on positions of legislation, I probably shouldn't get out ahead of where the administration is as a whole.
I don't speak for the government, so I will get out ahead of it. I think sort of concrete metrics, right? How much U.S. person's information is actually collected, how often it's queried, for what purpose, right? So an additional level of detail such that people can make meaningful assessments, right? So it's important to place numbers in context because a lot of times these numbers emerge and it's without proper context, you can't actually understand what they mean. But an attempt to bring more detail so that people can make evaluations about how it's actually applied. The current level of abstraction, I think that there is space to be more detailed about, you know, sort of use, purpose specification, post-collection searches, how many times other agencies access the data and for what purposes. I think that's all places in which there's probably some concrete areas that there could be improvement.
Last question for Bob, if anybody's got one. That's how much they do not want to ask that. Yeah, please.
Well, in Title I of FISA, we have the equivalent of a warrant. It's not technically a warrant in the same way, but I think when people say warrant, it's shorthand for the combination of a court decision and a factual foundation based on probable cause. Whether you call it a warrant or something else, I think that's what's intended when people talk about a warrant in this context.
There's also the question, there's a 702 is geared towards surveillance of non-U.S. persons, but incidentally, a lot of U.S. person information is typically collected, and sometimes that's searched. And so the question of a warrant requirement is to ensure that they are meeting the standard that they would have had to meet in the first instance to collect that U.S. person information in order to access it through a database where they didn't have to meet that standard in the collection.
Yeah, sort of. As Bob mentioned, there are, under other titles of FISA, there is a sort of a functional equivalent. I think the way people think about the difference sort of in the warranted versus warrantless surveillance is a specific selector, right? So an actual individual versus these broader certifications. In the law enforcement space, we think about those things quite differently. One, because we're talking about U.S. persons. Two, we're talking about something that's operationally very different. So one of the reasons why 702 changed to sort of this authorization, this broader programmatic authorization, with of course very specific targeting procedures that incorporate a lot of those concerns, or those sort of incorporate mechanisms to address those precise concerns. I think the risk here is that if we essentially place a requirement by which the intelligence community would have to expend the resources in order to gain to go and seek out an individual warrant for each selector, because of the way our adversaries, both in the foreign intelligence space and also in the court counterterrorism mission, use different email addresses, use different phones, right? The operational space, that's not. The current formulation of 702 is attempted to both embody those values and those protections while at the same time having sort of operational flexibility. So I think it's sort of it's trying to bring in the values without putting that far more difficult and resource-intensive mechanism on top of it.
Yeah, and I just want to add one thing to clarify this, because this is an object, this is an issue that frequently causes confusion in 702. 702 surveillance today is still done on an individualized targeted basis. It is not bulk surveillance. It's done on the basis of individual selectors. It's just that it's not done on the basis of an application to the court to show probable cause for each of those selectors. The selectors are chosen pursuant to the targeting procedures that the court approves, but it's still individualized surveillance. And with that, I will have to leave. I do have a meeting I have to get to back out in the undisclosed location where our offices are, which I think you can find on the internet if you look for it. Thanks very much for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. We can still take, if anybody's got any last-minute questions. No? And with that, we'll call it. Thanks, guys, so much for being here.